The challenge is that Amazon doesn't make this easy. They won't allow you to just create multiple accounts, first of all, without getting permission. And in order to get permission, you have to have a separate company. Like you have to have a separate, either a separate ownership structure, separate EIN, separate checking account, separate credit card. All this stuff has to be 100% separated out in order for them to grant you permission to create another Amazon account. So we are going through that now. And I mean, what a disaster. Like we're trying to close within about 6 weeks of recording this. And to hand over the account at closing, we have to have just brand A, you know, which is going to be Color It, in the Amazon account, and brand C or B, C, D have to be out of the Amazon account and in a new account. And like it has to happen as seamlessly as possible, which is impossible.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Joe, you got to have one of our favorite podcast guests on, Mike Jackness. And Mike actually retained you or hired you to help sell one of his properties. And we get to do another episode. Is this part of our amazing acquisitions? I don't know. Our amazing exits, I'm sorry.
Incredible exits. Come on, Mark. Get it.
My goodness.
Get it right. I made it up. It's a good, I don't even know what it's called. Somebody's going to tell me there's a certain term for things that flow off the tongue very well. Incredible.
It's almost as if I'm not paying attention to what you're doing at all. You got to have him on the podcast about selling his business.
Indeed.
I'd like to know about it.
You know, he's just an awesome human being, and that made selling his business and the person buying it that more excited about it. But Mike is an influencer. He has a podcast where he's got 30,000 people listening to him every month and talks about e-commerce and email marketing and Amazon. We had challenges because people were like, well, if Mike Jackness isn't killing it with this, I don't know if I can do any better. But the reality was Mike was just simply chasing too many rabbits, as he says. He had four brands inside of one seller account. He has the podcast and he has other projects going on. So he wasn't giving his full attention to this. So really the reason I wanted to have him on was to have people hear from him, someone that is well-known and an influencer, much in a much larger audience in his podcast than we have, what he was doing wrong. If he could go back and do it all over again, how he would have changed things so that it would have been an easier process for him, and we had multiple offers, but would have had a much easier process in reaching those multiple offers. And some of the key differences that he did to seal the deal. He didn't do it to seal the deal. He was just doing it anyway, and it is what sealed the deal and got us under LOI at 96% of the list price.
Yeah, you know, one of the most popular articles that I wrote on our blog back when I was doing all of the blogging on Quiet Light Brokerage was the story of my own process of buying a business and, in my own estimation, failing at it. You know, and frankly, as the founder of Quiet Light, it's kind of humbling to go out there and say, yep, I made an acquisition. I completely failed. But here's why. And I got so much good feedback from that saying, this is great. Thank you for sharing these details because it really helps. So hearing someone from someone like Mike Jackness, and his episode that you did with him is probably my favorite episode that we have that I've listened to. I don't listen to my own episodes, which is why they aren't like 1 through 50. That episode from Mike Jackness, in all seriousness, he talks about email marketing and how he does email marketing. It's fantastic. So if you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to it. But it'd be interesting to hear what he had as far as his own self-assessment when it comes to selling his business and some of the struggles that he had as well. And I think it might be encouraging for those of us that are out there, like, how are these guys doing all of it? Because we only hear about the successes, right?
Yeah, there's challenges in here. And I was my initial plan was to do a two-part series, but we managed to get it all in. It's a little long, folks. It's about 45 minutes or so. And then the plan is to do a follow-up episode about due diligence, closing, transition, and training. We may even have the buyer on and have all three of us on the podcast.
It's 45 minutes?
Yes.
I should shut up. We should get to it.
Let's go to it. Hey, folks, Joe Valley here from Quiet Light Brokerage. And today I've got somebody that's been on before, Michael Jackness from Ecom Crew. Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast.
Welcome back.
Welcome back is right. Thanks. And you actually inspired this type of episode, as I said before we recorded. Folks, Mike has, when he was on before, he shared his expertise on email marketing and the use of Klaviyo. Today, he's actually going to be our first exit entrepreneur or incredible exits guest. Mike decided to list his business for sale last December. We talked about it. We got it listed. And now we're under letter of intent. We're recording this on February 12th, and we wanted to share Mike's direct experience so that you hear about the process and what you should do right, what you've done right, and what you do wrong, and hear from somebody other than me. Mike's been through it. He's got an audience of 30,000 listens on a monthly basis at Ecom Crew. If you're not listening to Ecom Crew, I know I'm promoting another podcast, but it's one of the absolute best out there. Go to ecomcrew.com. They're always helping entrepreneurs in the e-commerce space. So, Michael Jackness, 30 seconds. Just tell some folks who you are again for those that didn't listen to the first episode.
Yeah, I'm basically a serial entrepreneur. I started my first business when I was a kid. I did have a stint for 7 years in corporate life. One of my clients did hire me. But for the last 15 years, I've been doing my own thing, either in affiliate marketing or e-commerce the last 5+ years. And when I got into e-commerce, I realized that we were coming at things a little bit differently. We kind of came at it as a tech company rather than a product company. And we realized we had a lot to share. So the entire process, pretty much, as you mentioned, Ecom Crew, we've been blogging and podcasting and telling the world about what we've been doing. And one of the things that makes us unique is we also talk about all the negatives, not just the positive sunshine, blow smoke up your ass crap. In fact, we go out of our way to talk about some of the hardships of running a business and specifically e-commerce. So yeah, that's a 10,000 foot view.
And in just about 30 seconds. So thanks. Yeah. I can't emphasize enough. If you are a current e-commerce owner, you should listen to Ecom Crew as well, especially the Under the Hood series that I enjoy so much and inspired the incredible exit series here at Quiet Light. All right, Mike, at one point, you came to me, you reached out, I think probably around Thanksgiving or so, and said you wanted to exit. Did you plan that well in advance, or did you just find yourself tired and ready to move on?
Yeah, there were a ton of factors that went into that initial conversation. We had a different plan. I can tell you, we'll talk a little bit about that, but the plan was to do this a little bit longer. But I actually just did a podcast about risk factors in e-commerce, and we don't have 30 minutes to go over the entire episode, but there were 10 risk factors that I called out, which basically were like the amount of inventory that you have, tariffs, taxes, just kind of like a risk to reward type of thing. Competition, Amazon getting involved in brands, Amazon shutting your account down, getting unbalanced to be more Amazon than not off Amazon, things of this nature. And for me, what I realized, I started waking up one day realizing that for us, this stuff had kind of gone a little bit out of balance. We're at a point right now as we're doing this podcast, because we haven't quite done the exit yet, where we have $1.3 million in inventory total, like company-wide. As we've been growing, as you know, in e-commerce, it's hard to get any money out of your business because we were growing at 100% per year. And it's a situation where money just keeps on piling back in the business. You have a tax bill every year without the money to even pay for that because you're plowing everything back in the inventory for growth. And we have been running at that speed for almost 4 years. And because of some of those other risk factors, the kind of the levers changing a little bit, I felt like it was time that we needed to take some chips off the table. And combining that with just honestly being a little burned out, running at that speed is definitely exhausting. I found myself either dreaming about Amazon shutting my account down or waking up every morning first thing and checking my inbox and seeing if it had been shut down. Not because we do anything black hat at all, but because I see things that happen out there because of Ecom Crew and also like the Million Dollar Seller forums. You hear stories of people that legitimately didn't do anything wrong, but it doesn't matter because Amazon can be the judge and jury and executioner all in one. And you know, factoring all these different things in, it felt like it was time. And we didn't know, when I had that initial conversation with you, didn't know exactly what that was going to look like. At one time we had talked about selling everything. I was kind of like just in a bad mood that day. And then we kind of started walking through some more realistic and better options to kind of end up where we ended up at that finally.
Well, let's talk about that, the realistic option of selling everything and how things were set up. Because I really want people to learn from you know, this process and what your goals were and the challenges that we've had and some of the amazing things that you've done throughout the process as well. So the first thing we looked at was selling all four of the brands that you have. You have it under one LLC, and two of the brands are doing very, very well, and two of the brands are startup brands where they're really working at a loss because you have a tendency to just focus on organic traffic and brand recognition for a series of months to a year and don't mind operating at a loss. First and foremost, you know, Mark did a podcast with somebody from a PE firm that painted this picture. He said, the thing about private equity investors is, well, think about it when you were a kid. He says, you get a bag of marbles from, and you're trying to negotiate a deal with your buddy for the bag of marbles. First thing you want to do is reach into that bag of marbles and take out all the chipped ones. You don't want to buy the chipped marbles. And then you want to focus on the best marbles. And so in looking at your four brands, two of them were really operating at a loss. So my advice right away was, let's take those out of the picture. Because, you know, when you're selling a business, let's say at a 3x multiple, and you have two brands in the bag, and they're both operating at, you know, let's say negative $10,000 in discretionary earnings, that's $20,000. Times three, that's $60,000 off the list price of your business if you go with the, you know, the multiple of discretionary earnings valuation model, which is what we do in marketplace valuations. So we had to pull those two out. And then we looked at what at the time was one of the larger brands of the two. We've got Colorit that we've talked about. We've talked about openly, and you've done presentations all over the world on your email marketing campaigns with Klaviyo and Colorit. But the other one, different space. And we had a challenge. See, one of the things that we talk about all the time are the four pillars of a sellable business. It's age, documentation, growth, transferability. And the big thing that we had a problem there was the transferability of that particular brand. Two of the SKUs that you had, which were not the largest SKUs by any stretch, you were reselling those, right? And you reached out to your vendor to confirm that you could transfer those. And what did they say?
They said no.
Simple as that. So that takes away one of the pillars. It makes it more complicated. But again, you know, as you said, you were in a bad mood that day that we talked. A lot of emotions in selling your business. And as you say in the introduction that we did for Color, you're chasing too many rabbits. When you're doing that, you're getting tired and exhausted and pulled in too many different directions and often going nowhere. So we ended up setting that one aside as well and focused only on Colorit and went with that to launch. Before we get into the initial launch multiple and things that we found that were really amazing about it, we found one more challenge, right? Or maybe two, right? You have one LLC with all four brands under one LLC and all four brands in one seller account. What have you done since our initial conversations back in late November, early December to rectify that?
Yeah. Let me kind of set the stage just real quick of why we got there as well, because it's interesting in business. There's two phenomena that this exists in. First of all, I've been in business for like 15 years. So like I kind of knew some of the hiccups and roadblocks we might get into down the road, but I had run multiple businesses in the past. So like whenever you like do something and you don't like it, you tend to like correct for that in another way in a future endeavor, whether it's a business or in personal life. And the thought of like having, we actually have more than four things going through this LLC. There's other non-e-commerce stuff and some other things as well. And the thought of like having like six or seven different tax returns and credit cards for each business and trying to figure out how we're going to separate employees or like the lease or, you know, back-end software like a Skubana or, you know, a UPS account, all these different things, like having to have them all segmented out just was not appealing to me in any way, shape, or form. And I was more concerned about like today than tomorrow as far as like operating the business. And I also had this thought process of like, when I'm ready to get out of e-commerce, I'm going to get rid of all of it at once. Like I'm a pretty binary kind of guy. Like I'm either all in or not doing it. And I thought the day that when it came that we would get out of e-commerce, we would just sell that conglomerate. But you know, life happens and business happens. And like I said, some of these risk factors changed. And the reality was, is that we wanted to pivot and change our philosophy and our business plan pretty quickly. I equate this also to like you're when you want to pay taxes, you want to like have your business show like the lowest amount of money. You're trying to figure out any expense you can have. Like that's really good for taxes. But like when you go to apply for a loan, it's better to be showing lots of income. So it's like, it's a similar kind of phenomena where like in one part, it makes sense to do one thing, but in another, on the other side, it makes sense to do another. So we were kind of at that spot where it was obvious that this was going to be a problem because the things that came up in the calls over and over again were really two things. Number one, shared resources of employees or other resources, which I understand the challenge there. And also the fact that like everything's in this one Amazon account. And let me tell you, man, like if there was anything I can go back and do differently, it would be having multiple Amazon accounts at a much earlier stage. The challenge is that Amazon doesn't make this easy. They won't allow you to just create multiple accounts, first of all, without getting permission. And in order to get permission, you have to have a separate company. Like you have to have a separate, either separate ownership structure, separate EIN, separate checking account, separate credit card. All this stuff has to be 100% separated out in order for them to grant you permission to create another Amazon account. So we are going through that now. And I mean, what a disaster. Like we're trying to close within about 6 weeks of recording this. And to hand over the account at closing, we have to have just brand A, you know, which is going to be Color It, in the Amazon account, and brand C or B, C, D have to be out of the Amazon account and in a new account. And like, it has to happen as seamlessly as possible, which is impossible because we only have inventory in Amazon, like all our inventory is in Amazon. So we're having to like recall some of it, relabel, like get it into the other account. We keep a relatively slim amount of stuff in Amazon. So it's not, you know, looking at it on a SKU by SKU basis, it isn't that big of a deal, but like, because we're, you know, a high seven-figure seller total, we're recalling truckloads worth of goods from Amazon. It's not going to be cheap. And when you recall stuff, it gets damaged a lot of times. Like the stuff shows up and looks used by the time you're shipping it in, it's getting, someone's handling it, putting it on the shelf, and they got to go take it off the shelf, put it in another, you know, box and crate. And when you recall stuff, it doesn't come back in the best of shape. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of a disaster all around, but this is what we've had to do to get to where we are. And moving forward, they are all going to be separate companies. So at any point when the time comes to put business B up for sale, we'll have it all in one clear, concise company, one account, and we'll just pull the trigger and be done.
Yeah. You know, I think you had said at one point, you knew what to do. And you had one plan, you know, was to sell the entity and all the brands within it at one time. And then we found three stumbling blocks, two that were operating at a loss because you were focused on organic traffic and brand building. And one where, you know, two of the vendors said, yeah, no, we like you, Mike. We don't know anybody else. We're not going to do this deal with anyone else. So you run into challenges there. And you also said, you know, if you have to make those changes someday, you'll do that. And all of a sudden you woke up and someday was here and we had, you know, action that we wanted to take right away. Whereas, you know, the idea of, I always say, you know, don't decide to sell, which is, I mean, eventually you do decide to sell, but plan to sell. So my little slogan there doesn't actually work all that well, but seriously, I think the thing to do is to plan it out in advance as much as possible to make it, strangely enough, as easy and seamless as possible for the buyer, for that person that is going to put $1 million of their life savings on the line, or two or three or 100,000. The amount doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money for the person that's stroking the check or sending the wire. So that's the key thing.
Can I I want to mention one other thing, if you don't mind, just real quick before moving the next thing.
Yeah.
You're asking just like kind of like some of the other things that kind of went wrong, or we could have done better. This is stuff that's often not talked about, again, in entrepreneurship, but the reality is that you either would have been better just to have one brand and focus on it, or maybe two, rather than trying to do too many things at once, which is a trap that a lot of entrepreneurs get caught in. Something I tell myself all the time. I even had it in writing on a blog post like 8 years ago, like, I won't do that again, get into too many things. Entrepreneurs are, you know, different. There's different classes of entrepreneurs, but the kind of entrepreneur that I am, it's the squirrel syndrome. It's always exciting to do something new rather than what you're working on. I get bored really easily. Like, to me, the business aspects are way less about the money than like the personal enjoyment and excitement part of it. And oftentimes that ends up, you know, you end up with this you chase two rabbits, both will get away, saying that I use all the time, but I give that advice and don't follow it as well as I should. So that's another thing that you could really take away from this. If you're the existing business you have is probably the best one that you have. Same type of thing with like a car, like the cheapest car you'll ever have is the one that you own right now, rather than going out and buying a new one, or any of these types of things can be applied to other aspects of your life as well. But you know, if you are focused on one company, like you typically have like all your T's crossed and I's dotted, and that's how I like to run my companies, because I am a bit of a perfectionist. But as you spread your resources across multiple businesses, things start to fall through the cracks. It makes things less attractive to a buyer. And the reality is it's not as easy as it should be to just cookie cutter your business into another one. We had a really great podcast about this like a year and a half ago. It was actually something we recorded live at E-Commerce for Live last year back in Laguna. So, I mean, I don't know, I just want to throw those things out as well as just other things that to be thinking about as you're planning your exit. You should be, you know, a lot of times it's, well, I want to get into this other thing, or what, you know, you're, as you're growing, it's really exciting and it's infectious and you want to keep on that path because it's fun to tell everybody like how fast you're growing and everyone pats you on the back, and you know, society makes things even worse because they're all like, always like, yeah, man, good job. And no one's ever going to be like, oh, good job, you only grew by 5% last year, because that's just how we're all wired. Which the reality is that as Dave Bryant, my partner, always says, is that, revenues are vanity and profits are sanity. So,
anyway. Yeah, for Andrew, sure.
Sorry.
No, I love that. You know, again, this is, I want people to hear from you more than me. I say this stuff all the time, and you're someone that's going through it right now and coaches, you know, thousands of people on a regular basis to, you know, improve their businesses and Dave as well. The other thing that separating out the brands and separating out the LLC does for you, the seller, and the potential buyer is it casts a broader net of potential buyers. And the broader the net, the more interest level there's going to be in the business, and the more interest level, the more likely you're going to get an offer at or close to closing, close to list price. And in this case, we did not say SBA pre-qualified. Technically, you can take a business like yours and go through the process and have your accountant separate all those things out and you know, certify it. It's not a full audit. And you could try to go through the process and make it SBA pre-qualified. But in the time frame that you and I were trying to do this, you wanted to be under letter intent by January 31st. It didn't happen. We came close, but we couldn't have gone through that process because that process would have taken, you know, 6 to 8 weeks for your attorney to do it. And given the time of year, it might have taken longer because he's in full on tax preparation now. So that's the other thing that separating out your LLCs by brand will do for you, is that when you wake up one day and you want to exit, it's clean, it's simple, and you can do that with a lot less work. And that work, Mike, it was a lot of work in preparing the listing for sale. In the profit and loss statements, and then in that client interview, everybody's heard about it. I told my wife when I sold my business, I felt like I was working harder preparing the business for sale and going through the process of getting it sold than I was actually running it. And when I was running mine, I was working about 20 hours a week running the business. So that tells you what that workload is like. In terms of what we did, I want to talk a little bit about the launch process and talk about the multiples and some of the things we did that you did just absolutely right, spot on. We did go out a little early though, right? We talked in late November, early December, and you had a goal and I wanted to help you achieve that goal. I'm human. And I think that what I probably should have done in hindsight is said, no, this is probably not the best approach. We went out in, I think, around the 10th of December, listed the business at a pretty strong multiple. It was at a 4x multiple. And we went out and said, look, December is going to be great. Trust us, these numbers will drop to a 3.5 once the December numbers are in. And the ultimate answer we got was, cool. I think I'll just wait to see if that's true. So we had a phone call. Maybe we had one buyer seller conference call in the month of December. And then you're a man of your word and you like to under promise and over deliver. And when December numbers came in, they were up 80% year over year.
Yeah.
Now, I've used this analogy with a lot of folks before, and they've heard me say this again. You can list something at a 4x multiple, and if it's growing 25% year over year consistently, the buyer earns their money back in 2.7 years. I did not do the math on 80%, and I won't. But that really got people off the fence a little bit. We updated the P&Ls, got the December P&Ls, and then we're relaunching, I think, on January 8th, 9th, or 10th, in and around there. And we actually dropped the price by $75,000 too. So the multiple didn't drop to just a 3.5. It dropped to a 3.2 multiple. And we relaunched. And I think we had three or four phone calls out of the gate. The goal is to have 3 to 5 in the first 30 to 45 days and one acceptable offer. We did have just two offers in this case. And one was just not there. We had two or three phone calls with them. One was interesting, right? I was traveling to Dallas. So I'm on a conference call with Mike and the buyer, and I'm actually going through TSA security on the conference call. And thankfully, Mike can talk, folks. So he was talking as I put my headset down and went through security, picked it up on the other end. You were still talking. And you had a terrible cold. So that was...
Yeah, that was a pretty embarrassing call.
It was great though. And the thing that you do so incredibly well is you instill confidence in the buyers. You're honest, people trust you, and it made them, anybody that had the opportunity to talk with you, I think wanted to make an offer if they could pull it together. But we couldn't do an SBA buyer because of that commingling issue. So we were focused primarily on cash buyers. Keep in mind though, that not all SBA buyers don't have the cash. Many of them do. They just prefer to make their money go further with an SBA loan. So I think we were both at ECF, that's e-commerce fuel, at the event down in New Orleans. And I drove you nuts a few times saying, I think I might have an offer, right?
It was so funny. Like, you texted me at the opening party, like, I think I have an offer, and then you went to bed. But like, you didn't actually have the offer yet. I just like I think I read the text a little wrong, but so I was like walking around the entire thing, like, look at, like, anybody know where Joe Valley is? Anybody know where Joe Valley is?
Yeah. And I think I heard somebody say, Joe likes to go to bed early. He doesn't stay up late at these events. He's probably in bed. And that, I felt a little embarrassed there. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm getting a reputation for going to bed by 9, but we ended up not going under LOI.
I had better in the morning than I did.
I think I probably did. I was really hopeful that we could go under LOI while at e-commerce field, because I thought it'd be a great feather in your cap, and mine would be able to have a drink there and celebrate, but it didn't quite work. It took an extra probably 4 or 5 days. But we had some challenges with the business. We ended up getting fairly close, and I'll do the math as you answer this next question in terms of that asking price, that 3.2 multiple. But we had some challenges. And the big challenge was something you talked about earlier. One of these big issues that you've got is you're taking all the profits from the business and putting it back into inventory. And when you have a business that's growing at the rate that yours was, that's a lot of inventory. Can you talk about that a little bit in terms of the challenges that we had there?
With inventory specifically in terms of with Color It?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and this is something that we have worked really hard on in our business and we're very cognizant of, which is that you basically want as little inventory as humanly possible at all times, right? I mean, you don't, there's a lot of reasons for this. If you have too much inventory, when something goes wrong, like you're stuck with a hot potato, that always sucks. But probably more importantly, especially when you're in this growth phase, is cash flow is the most important thing. There's this saying that's been around forever, which is cash is king. And there's a reason for this. For every dollar that you have in excess inventory, that's a dollar that you don't have in some new product, you know, some new product launch or some other thing that can make you more money. And every inventory business is going to go through this. There is no inventory business, I think, on earth that, especially one that's newer and growing at this speed, that can plan inventory perfectly all the time. Either you're going to err on the side of caution of not having too much inventory and be willing to run out of SKUs because of that, or you're going to err on the side of caution of having too much inventory and err on the side of caution of never running out of a SKU. And for me, we went with the latter, because in the early days of selling on Amazon, we realized that when you run out of stuff, it can be really detrimental. We had one SKU that we still are trying to recover from. It's a part of this legacy issue here with this business sale, where now we have too much inventory because we can never get it to recover back to the point where it was before. So, you know, we try to, in our inventory business, turn our inventory 3 to 4 times a year, which means that you should have no more than 3 to 4 months of inventory at any one time. And with ColorIt, that was definitely not the case. It is not the case. I mean, there's a bunch of different exceptions that put things way further out than that. There was an old legacy book manufacturer that we worked with that had very high MOQs. So if we wanted to even sell the item, we'd have to order a year worth of it at one time. And that was the decision that we made and came to. We had a newer product that we just started selling, and it was selling really well. So we've ordered more of it, just, you know, and again, at their MOQ. So we have more than 4 months of inventory there. And so the bottom line was that of the it's actually almost $400,000 in total inventory that we had for ColorIt, both from stuff that's in stock and things that we had already placed orders for that haven't shown up yet. There was about I don't have the numbers in front of me, but about $100,000-ish, I think, of inventory that would take longer than 12 months to sell. And so for me, because I've been on both sides of the fence as both a buyer and a seller of businesses, and I really believe living life, like, don't ask others that don't do what you wouldn't do yourself. I realized that before we even start talking to anybody, that we're probably going to have to make some sort of concession on the inventory. Like, it just would be unrealistic to just be like, nope, like, you're going to take the inventory and too bad. Because I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that myself. But the other thing that I don't like doing is like having someone pay me with my money. So the one thing I was steadfast about was like, we're not going to take financing or delay the purchase price. I want an all cash offer for the purchase price. But the inventory component, I thought the right thing to do was to pretty quickly acquiesce and come to a middle ground with a buyer. So what we agreed to do was, first of all, there was one SKU that I admit what just doesn't sell well, was a bad buy on us. We just wrote it off 100%. It's about $8,000. They can either throw it in a trash can if they want to transfer, they can keep it and do whatever they want with it. There were a couple of SKUs that I kind of conceded to that were slower movers that I felt like was going to be kind of detrimental to their business to buy it at, you know, 24 months worth of inventory at face value. So what we agreed to was, we'll sell you anything that we think is going to take longer than 12 months worth of that inventory at a 50% haircut. Like, we'll just write off half of it and you can buy it for 50% off. So now yes, you're carrying more inventory, but you're buying it at a price that makes sense to carry it. And then the third group of SKUs were things that were basically like in this 12 to 18 month window. They weren't really that overstocked. And the biggest culprit of that was this new item that we're trending higher on. So I think that ultimately, and I, you know, convinced the buyer ultimately, especially once the Christmas season comes, they aren't going to actually have 12 more than 12 months worth of inventory. So we agreed that even though our forecast shows it's going to take more than 12 months to sell, it's because we were using like a January sales number for that. We weren't including sales growth in that forecast. And we also weren't including what inevitably we knew was going to happen in December, which is December is about 3x any other month in our business. So ultimately we wrote off $40,000 worth of inventory and agreed to give them 12 months financing on the inventory at 5% interest, which basically, like, I think helps normalize that situation for them. And it's also something that I can tolerate as well.
Yeah. And it happened and we succeeded with it, because of you, the likability and trust factor. But you have something that I preach again, and that's when you've got an inventory-based business, you should have inventory aging reports. Sophisticated buyers are going to ask for them, and they're going to want to see the inventory by SKU, when you bought the inventory and how old it is, how many months you've got. As Mike said, you want to turn your inventory every 3 to 4 months if you can, but in his situation, it was 9, 12, 18 months in some rare instances. And so on that inventory report, one of the key things that your buyer, Matt, said that made a difference for him in sealing this deal and getting it done was the inventory aging report and the notes that you put by each SKU. And right there in one of them, you said, this is old inventory and it's not going to sell, so we'll write this off. You just acquiesced on that 8,000. He didn't ask for it. You just put it in there because you knew it was the right thing to do. And then you went line by line on every other SKU and justified the 100% value or where you needed to discount. And let me just say for everybody listening, it is rare to need to take a note on inventory. It's rare to have to discount it. But when you've got that much, you've got to do the right thing. What I don't want to happen here is for buyers to go, oh, well, hey, Jack just took a note. I'm always going to ask for a note. Because that's really, really the exception rather.
Like, I wouldn't do that with ice drops, for instance, because if we were to sell that, we have 4 months with the inventory. It's really clean and smooth. It's a more established business with fewer SKUs. It doesn't have a lot of the other things that cause us to have extra inventory. And like you said, I mean, you know, it's just doing the right thing and being realistic of both sides. I mean, this is what happened. Like, a lot of people, when they're sellers, they want to be way up here. When they're buyers, they want to be way down here. And they're just like, they have this gap in which I think that just makes them, you know, not the best of human beings. Right. I mean, you got to be like more in the middle and, like, you know, realize the person that's buying and what they're thinking and what their frame of mind is. And, you know, conversely, when you're on the sell side, be thinking about that as well. It's not always like just about you. Right. And what you're, there's another side to the coin. And I wish our politicians could learn this a little bit as well. Right. But it's just good business. It's being a good human being. It's what makes deals get done, is just doing the right thing and being fair about it, like being equitable about it. Like I would feel like a dirty, like, shyster if I like had that guy buy that one SKU that, like, I know, like, he doesn't know the business as well as I do. Like, I know that one SKU that we wrote off the AK, like, it's been around here for 2 years. No matter how hard we try to sell, we throw it at a 50% off sale, or we even did a 75% off sale around Christmas to try to get rid of some of them. Like, people just don't like that title. It was the one title that we made at a 25. It's a pretty good track record, but, you know, one title at 25 that was just this complete failure. And, like, how could you ask someone to, like, take that? Like, that's just basically, like, almost stealing from them, like, or trying to pull the rug over their head. And, you know, like, when they discover that later, which they probably will in due diligence, they're going to trust you.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say that they are going to discover in due diligence. And I tell you what, for folks listening, we're going to run a little bit long on this episode, and we're going to lock this all up in one episode instead of doing two series here. The due diligence process would reveal anything like that. So you need to get ahead of it. You have to be a good human being. This is a transaction that has to end with two satisfied individuals or entities at the closing table. That's the buyer and the seller. It's not winner takes all, because the buyer is putting their life savings on the line again, and they can walk away at any time. If you fake it, lie, cheat, or steal, it is going to be discovered in due diligence. More and more folks are hiring Centurica. Your buyer is. That's Chris Yates' team. Chris owns a company called Centurica. It's Centurica. They do due diligence for buyers. And honestly, as a broker, I love it when they join the team, because they're working for the buyer. And I have yet to see a deal go sideways on any of the listings that we've put out. What they do more than anything else is they reinstill confidence that the numbers are right, that the seller presented information, and they create a roadmap to growth. They can point out certain things where there's flaws, and sometimes it's a little scary, but the buyer goes, oh, okay, well, that's a flaw. I can fix that. I can make this better. And it's a path growth that we aren't able to do in the client interview, which is great. One other thing I just want to say that we won't get into in great detail, but without question, when you plan to sell instead of decide to sell, one of the things that you should always do, your partner Dave did it, is take a look at your cost of goods sold. And if there's a possibility that you can renegotiate your cost of goods sold 12 months out in advance and reduce that cost of goods sold, for every $10,000 you save, you're going to wind up with at least, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 times that, depending upon your business and the trends and whatnot. Mike, you did it, but you were able to renegotiate the cost of goods sold on just one of your SKUs, and you placed an order for it, so it was locked in and loaded, and the future sales would all be locked in at that lower cost of goods sold. And you sold through all of the other stuff at the higher price. So we were able to increase your seller's discretionary earnings by a total of $43,000 on that overall. And it was just because of that one SKU where you were able to renegotiate the cost of goods sold. In hindsight, Mike, do you wish you had done it on all of the other SKUs as well?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this is necessarily a selling your business thing more than this is just good business. Could have been time.
Yep. Yeah.
What I've realized, again, after 4+ years of importing stuff from China is that I wasn't as good of a negotiator as I thought I was. And I've always thought of myself as a really good negotiator in all aspects of anything that I do in business. And you know, we had negotiated down from like the original price they gave us, but it still wasn't like the Chinese price. And when you get like a really good sourcing agent, or you have someone that's like more in tune with the local business and customs there, probably get a better price. And that's what happened for us. We met somebody, and these contacts are hard to find in business. We were out there doing it all ourselves, like going to the Canton Fair, walking the floor, finding manufacturers, you know, and we did that because we were never able to really find a good sourcing agent, didn't really know any other way to go about it. But because mostly because of Ecom Crew, which is, you know, one of these things where like the more you give back in life, a lot of times the more you get rewarded. A lot of things we do when Ecom Crew, we don't get anything direct for our time for what we do. Like most of the stuff is just giving people free information and giving back to the community. But what I found that happens in these types of situations is that makes relationships with people, and the people you meet, they know people, that makes relationships with other people. And eventually that path like led to us finding this amazing sourcing agent that not only is he helping with color, but everything else that we're doing now. And he was in our office here one day. We were actually sourcing something else for our tactical brand. I wasn't even looking to like resource products. I was looking to source new stuff. We were just chit-chatting, and we have this display up on our wall, like of all of our products. And he's like, what if I try to go source this for you? Like, what do you pay for it? If I can do better, will you buy it from me? And I was like, well, I mean, like, I'm also like, not just about money. Like, I'm really about relationships. I really like the factory I work with. We've been working with them for a while. It had to be like one hell of a cost savings for me. Like, if it was, I'm going to save, you know, a couple $1,000s here and there, it's not worth it for me to like blow that up. But he came back and was able to reduce the price of that particular thing from, well, he reduced it by like 16% is what it was, which is massive. It's like this ridiculous cost savings. And at the same time, the other factory, as much as it's so funny, like I'm like really big on relationships and like was really concerned about them. They actually copied our product like during this process, and like even like used our nameplates that we had paid for and everything, and released our product to someone else, sold our product to someone else, which we then had to go spend money on a lawsuit to fight them, which we got them to stop. But so between those two things, we switched. Now the sourcing agent is going out and repricing that stuff, and that's going to end up benefiting the buyer way more than it is for us on color, which is fine. But I guess the end result is you should always be looking at price. Even when you think you have the best price, you probably don't. There was a great presentation at ECF about this as well when it came to shipping rates. I don't know if you saw Craig Gentry's presentation on FedEx and UPS, but it was just like, if you think you have great rates, you don't. Like you can still do better, because there's still another, like they make you feel like you're getting the best deal ever because they're really good at negotiating. And it was similar with our products. And we realized that we could be saving quite a bit. And I mean, 16% is a huge difference on COGS. I mean, like it ends up in your net profit is way more than 16% increase, right? Because it's going to be skewed. It makes sure, because you're just throwing money right on the bottom line. So yeah, I mean, it was massive, and the timing was great because we did get some benefit. But yes, I wish that we had time to go through and renegotiate all the SKUs for sure.
Yeah. And I think you said it best. It's just good business. It makes smart business sense, not necessarily for the exit planning and the eventual exit and sale of your business. Can you say one more time what Dave always says? It's not profit, it's...
Yes, revenues are vanity and profits are sanity.
Perfect.
I mean, we all love I'm going to go off on a tangent, another tangent. You don't want me to end up, I got to. It's just like, people are always like pounding their chest. Like, I'm a 7-figure seller and, you know, I'm an 8-figure seller and I sell all this stuff. But no one ever goes around saying like, well, I sold $10 million worth of stuff last year, but I actually lost money doing it. I mean, there's plenty of businesses out there that are like that. It's very easy to get in that trap because it's actually pretty easy to sell stuff online. You can just spend way too much money on advertising and you can sell stuff. But like, the profits really actually matters.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where, you know, these marketplace valuations are. It's on the profits or discretionary earnings. All right. So look, I want to read one more thing and then we're going to wrap it up. I've said the seller, in this case, you, Mike, makes a huge difference in the sellability, if that's a word, of your business, how you act prior to selling the business, how you manage your business, and how you represent yourself all throughout makes an enormous difference. And the way that you handled yourself on the client interview, on the recorded interview that we did as part of the package, on the conference calls with buyers, in the inventory challenges that we had and writing those notes there and just acquiescing on that $8,000 in inventory that you knew was no good. It all made the difference. And it's why we're under letter of intent. I did the math. We're actually under letter of intent at 96% of the list price of the business. Again, the inventory we're doing on a note, which we don't love, but sometimes you have to do that. I want to just read an email that you sent to Matt, your buyer, you know, within a couple of hours of when we were under letter of intent, to just to reemphasize what's important and the way that a buyer should treat their sellers or sellers should treat their buyers. So here we go. I feel like I'm in second grade standing up and reading this book. Weird.
I was not planning on this being read, but it's okay.
It says Matt. His first name is Matt. We're not going to say what his last name is. I just received a signed LOI from you and wanted to take a minute to thank you for putting your faith in me and my love child, color it. It's been one heck of a ride, but I'm ready to pass off the baton and experience a year or two of not having too much on my plate. Of course, I realize there is still a lot to accomplish to get to the finish line, but I wanted to say cheers. With the growth rate of Colorit, along with some of the other fundamentals, I'm convinced this will be your best purchase to date. My goal is to make sure that it becomes a reality for you as we progress through the transition. I look forward to working with you in that regard over the next few months. Mike. Guys, that is the way to transact business. It's just the right thing to do when it feels good. And I can tell you, what do we have? 80% year-over-year growth in December. And didn't even mention it, 74% year-over-year growth in January made a huge difference in Matt, you know, making an offer at 96% of the list price. But this kind of thing, the way Mike handled himself as a professional and as a good human being in this entire process, sealed the deal ultimately. So Mike, thank you. I appreciate the way that it's gone so far. I think what we'll do is have a follow-up episode to talk about due diligence and the training and transition and how the transaction wound up at the end of the process with this closing that we've got, if you're willing to come back on.
Yeah. Can I say one thing about the letter that I wrote real quick?
Sorry. Of course.
Since you took the time to read it and I'm feeling a lot, but I don't know. I got to preach about it. Cause I've been on both sides, like I said, both sides of these deals. You know, there's been times where I've been the buyer, and at that moment you're like, that you sign the LOI, there's always like this anxiety, right? Where you're like, man, I just like, I'm about to like jump into this thing, and you don't necessarily know like what you're getting, everything you're getting yourself into. And, you know, I just wanted to let the guy know, like, first of all, I appreciate him again. Like, it was sincere. Like, I appreciate him. This was like, now the salesperson part's over. Like, I don't have to try to sell him anything, right? It's always awkward when you're saying stuff in the call part of it. It almost sounds manufactured, even though I don't do that, but I'm sure to them it comes off as like, this guy's probably just saying this to get me to write a check. But, you know, it's done. The finish line's there from that perspective. And I just, and I do want it to be a success story. Like, I want the guy to buy it and look back at this years later and feel like he made the right decision. And yeah, that was really all, just, you know, kind of just being sincere about it. And I think that all too often, again, people are more worried about themselves. They'd be off high-fiving everybody and saying that, you know, we got an LOI and celebrating their success more than thinking about like what this guy's about to endeavor in. And I think that's important.
I appreciate that. And the last thing I'll say is what I say to everyone, which is we're under a letter of intent. There's no guarantee.
Right. Exactly. Money's not in the bank yet, for sure.
Money's not in the bank yet. So let's have another killer month in February. We'll get through all of this. Due diligence is very detailed. But again, they've got Centurica doing it for them. We've got to do a lot of work, but we know it'll be done right. And that emotion will be left out of it as much as possible. And it'll be math and logic, and we'll get through it. And then we'll have you back on the podcast to maybe high five, and maybe we'll get buyer Matt on it as well.
Yeah, I think it'd be cool to have him come join us and talk about both sides.
All right. I'm looking forward to it, Mike. You're a good man. I'm glad to do business with you. Look forward to getting you back on the podcast.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.